Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silken in Edinburgh. I'm joined, as always, by Frank Cagliano. We are back from our brief summer hiatus. Frank, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, David. How was your holiday?
My holiday was great. Went to Normandy, saw all kinds of things I've been longing to see for many, many years. Listeners may not know this, but my birthday is June the 6th, which is D-Day, so I've had a connection with Normandy, at least on some kind of weird tangential level for my entire life. So, you know.
Had you been before?
I had not been before.
Oh, right.
So I was very
excited. What did you think?
Oh, it was really, Normandy is interesting in as much as you see U.S. flags, French flags, British flags, and
Canadian flags.
And Canadian flags and European Union flags everywhere, as if all these places actually got along, which in 2018 is kind of extraordinary.
Yeah, I suppose it's a fitting jumping off point for this week's pod.
Yes, exactly. So it was a weird, like they were allies or something. So the past week, Donald Trump went on what is probably not the most important presidential trip ever, but at least one of the more interesting and unusual and chronicled, I think, foreign trips. It started about a week ago with the 29th NATO summit, where he went to Brussels and met with other NATO leaders, including French President Emmanuel Macron and German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Then he proceeded on to the UK, where he met with Theresa May, the Prime Minister, and with the Queen. And then he proceeded on to Scotland, where he played a couple rounds of golf. And then on to Helsinki, where he met with Russian President Vladimir Putin, had a private meeting with President Putin, and a rather bizarre press conference. And in and amongst all that, there was all kinds of interesting protests here in the UK. Very odd.
Huge protests,
which we were both in London for and here in Edinburgh for. A weird interview with The Sun, and some interesting attacks on traditional American allies and chumming up with traditional American rivals. So it was a weird and interesting trip that we thought we'd like to see if we can provide some historical context for.
Yeah, I mean, the premise of this podcast, and thank you listeners who've stuck with us for all these weeks, is that we try to provide historic context for contemporary events. I think, however, we're slightly in terra incognita here in
yes.
the sense that I don't think there is an immediate precedent for, or a long past precedent for what we've seen in the past week. You did say, David, in your opening remarks, you said it was the most significant presidential trip ever, or so words to that effect.
Well, I think said it wasn't, but it was at least it was interesting and weird in terms of
right. Well, it's definitely that. Surely. FDR's wartime summits
would
have been more significant.
And Reagan's summits with Gorbachev in the
80s. Right, sure. Yes. But, sorry, I'm parsing your words in a slightly unfair way, because I think what we saw this week is really significant and could well be a turning point both in the history of U.S. foreign policy, but more immediately the history of the Trump presidency, I suspect.
But future graduate students, by the way, this would be or undergraduates, this would, you know, speaking for people 20 years in the future, if you're listening to this, this would be a really great dissertation project this whole week.
Yes.
Figuring out what's going on, what it means.
Although you might have to wait 50 years until the Russian recordings of the secret of the meeting they held in Helsinki are released, because surely there are recordings of that meeting.
Yes, no doubt.
So, yes, yes, that would be a very good topic. And in 20 years' time, we'll have a better sense of its significance. You know, I, for one, in my hopeful moments, think, you know, if there will be a president after Trump, there will be something after Trump, and maybe transatlantic relations will revert to the norm then, because everyone will want to see that happen. I may have said this on the pod before. I've certainly said it to you in our conversations before. The analogy the comparison I sometimes make is with the state of transatlantic relations in 2003-04, which, you know, I was here then. It was very, very low. The invasion of Iraq was very unpopular in Europe, and especially in the UK, which was involved, of course. And anti-Americanism was more pronounced then than it is now, I think. And things seemed really bad. And a lot of the things we heard then about a kind of permanent rift, et cetera, we're hearing now. With the election of Obama, there was a reversion to the norm that was pretty quick because I think both sides wanted that. Now, that, of course, gave birth to Trumpism at some level because there was this perception that Obama went around apologizing. I think if we're going to mend transatlantic relations and global relations, or the global relations of the United States after Trump, the next president is going to spend a lot of time apologizing. Sure. but so in my hopeful moments, I think that, but maybe not. Maybe this is a turning point. You know, maybe this is a turning point where, you know, things won't revert to the way they were. And well, we don't know. We simply don't know. We can't know.
Yeah, well, that's because our expertise is in the past, not the future.
As we demonstrate every week.
Exactly. That's why we don't gamble very much. I mean, one of the things that struck me about this trip is that, you know, none of these meetings should have been important. All of these should have been rather routine. You know, if you think about NATO summits in the past, unless there was a pressing crisis in the world, NATO summits should be amazingly boring, where the leaders get together, they all say, yep, we all defend each other. They might quibble about one or two little things. But NATO summits over the past 50 years generally been kind of dull political events where there's there's photo ops and there's you know, handshaking, but it shouldn't be breaking news about
no,
it.
No, apart from last year's summit where I believe that's the one where Trump shoved, I think it was the Prime Minister of Montenegro. But that's the only one you can remember, right?
Yes, because but
we don't remember NATO summits because nothing happens.
Under, you know,
and these things
Eisenhower onwards, like nobody...
These things are always choreographed.
Sure.
And planned, and so they shouldn't be surprising.
And state visits to the UK should similarly be...
It wasn't a state visit, but visits to the UK.
Yeah. I think it was originally supposed to be, and then
it
became...
But they downgraded, yeah.
But those are supposed to be boring.
Yeah, all you have to do is say the word special relationship at some time and not offend your host. I mean, we shouldn't, because of Helsinki...
Yeah.
You know, that has kind of, forgive the phrase, trumped everything. Mm. We shouldn't forget what happened here in the UK at the end of last week, which is, you know, as many of our listeners will know, there's an ongoing political crisis here that's roiling along over Brexit and a kind of crisis within the governing Conservative Party at the moment. So last weekend, so a week ago, or a week and a half ago now, two ministers from Theresa May's government resigned. So this was at the beginning of last week. Mm. So Theresa May was facing a crisis in her own party. In comes Donald Trump. And right before he was due to meet Theresa May at Chequers, her kind of country, the Prime Minister's country house, sort of the British Camp David, if you will, only nicer. Trump had this interview with the Sun newspaper, the biggest and kind of most outrageous tabloid in the UK, in which he totally undermined Theresa May's position within her own party, said she was doing a bad job negotiating Brexit. Now, one can argue that's true.
Yes.
But this at the very moment that she's being attacked for that very thing from the right wing of her party, he interfered in domestic British politics.
And sided with the right wing of the
Tory party. Yeah, and then had that bizarre press conference last Friday at Chequers with Theresa May when he tried to walk it back and repair the damage, but didn't do a terribly convincing job of it. And all the while, they did, you know, for an American president to come to the UK, his visit was shrouded in mystery so that protests couldn't gather where he was. They kept him away from people, the public, that is. It was an extraordinary low moment in the history of the special relationship, which should be a relatively easy thing for an American president to manage. Yet he came and he made Theresa May's position much, much worse.
Yes.
And it was
already in a bad position.
She's in a very parlous position right now. I mean, again, this isn't a podcast on British politics, but it wouldn't surprise me if her government falls sooner rather than later, frankly.
For American listeners who haven't been keeping up, sort of the Brexit negotiations haven't been going nearly as smoothly as the Conservatives promised. And there's been, the resignations have largely been over the fact that the Brexit negotiations haven't gone anywhere. At least in terms of meaningful outcomes.
Right, and there are a number, we might actually do something on Brexit later. There are a number, Brexit for Americans.
Yes.
Could, But yes, that's right. That's right. So that's the context in which Trump kind of blundered in and made things worse for what is arguably the closest ally of the United States, at least in security terms, and then to a large extent, cultural terms.
Sure.
I think I'm always reluctant to say that because I think it does a disservice to Canada.
To be yes.
but we need to, you know, it was an incredibly clumsy intervention in British, an unnecessary intervention in British politics, which only exacerbated the kind of antipathy that many in the British public feel for Trump. And there were huge protests in London last Friday. There were protests in Glasgow last Friday. And then on Saturday, there was a protest in Edinburgh. And that's where we saw the big inflatable baby Trump. Yes.
I actually missed the baby twice, unfortunately, because I had a late train. But the baby was right in front of my flat, basically. So you saw the baby?
I saw the baby in London and in Edinburgh.
Oh, you see, you got hit twice.
I had a double with the baby. Yeah, so, okay. So anyway, so this is, and we haven't even got to Helsinki yet. Yes. So the trip might have been a disaster to that point, because he'd insulted our NATO allies before coming to Britain. Mm. And then he went to Helsinki. And in Helsinki, he had this private meeting with President Putin, and then they came out and he gave a press conference. We know that President Trump doesn't give very many press conferences, and it was an extraordinary performance. I forgot a key element. While he was wreaking havoc in the UK last Friday, Mueller indicted 12 Russian agents, and these were agents of the Russian state
yes,
for interfering with the 2016 election. So that's the immediate backdrop to this meeting with Putin on Monday and the press conference they gave at the end of it, where Putin presented Trump with a soccer ball from the World Cup, which was slightly odd, and Trump threw it to Melania. Did you see that?
No, I didn't see that.
Okay. So Putin gives him the ball, which undoubtedly has a bug in it, I'm sure. Trump says thank you, and he's lavishing praise on Putin for such a successful World Cup, because the World Cup, of course, ended on Sunday. And Trump threw the ball to Melania in a slightly awkward way. I don't think he's very athletic anyway, so the way he threw the ball wasn't terribly convincing. But he also threw it in a way that wasn't the kind of thing you should do to your wife.
No.
So it was that was an odd moment, and that was not even the oddest moment. In fact, it wasn't the oddest moment in the... it wasn't even the 100th oddest moment in that press conference. The key takeaway from the press conference being Trump's refusal to blame Russia, despite the evidence, for interfering with the 2016 election. And basically saying both sides were to blame.
Which seems very much like the Charlottesville discourse. There was something that happened,
that's right,
and I don't want to assign blame to anybody. There were bad actors on both sides, which doesn't...
That's right, and I like your use of Charlottesville discourse, because he also used the passive voice like that. There was something that happened. Not, you did this to our system. He didn't come close to saying anything like that.
No.
Then we had a tweet from, not a tweet, but there were statements from various Republicans. But I think this was meant to be our point of departure today. There was a statement from John McCain.
Yeah, so this is in the media aftermath of the news conference. McCain said today's press conference in Helsinki was one of the most disgraceful performances by an American president in memory. The damage inflicted by President Trump's naivety, egoism, false equivalence, and sympathy for autocrats is difficult to calculate. But it is clear the summit in Helsinki was a tragic mistake. He later goes on to say that no prior president has ever abased himself more abjectly before a tyrant.
Discuss. David, if that were an exam question, how would you answer it?
So, there's a lot about all this that's unprecedented. I think that's one of the difficulties we've had in this whole podcast is trying to provide historical context for the Trump administration is challenging. American leaders, I think, often meet with political rivals, political adversaries.
And sometimes unsavory people.
And dictators and tyrants and generally bad actors. What's striking, I think, about the past week is the way that Trump treated our traditional allies with an enormous amount of hostility. The way he attacked Angela Merkel at the NATO summit, and the sort of way he attacked Theresa May and the son, and the ways in which he's sort of generally behaving around people who should be American allies or have been American allies. And he called the EU a rival or
a foe.
Which,
he identified as the biggest foe of the United States.
Which objectively doesn't make any sense at all.
Only in the Ryder Cup.
yes. But and then if you look at just simply this body language and the way that he talked about his relationship with Putin, you know, the disconnect between those two things, because he seemed like he was trying very, very hard to be Putin's friend and ally. And, you know, there was times in which during the press conference, a reporter asked Putin a question and Trump said it and said, let me help the other president answer this question. Like he's trying to, you know, back him up. And, you know, there's all these people who are hypothesizing online that, you know, Trump is a Russian puppet, the way that thinking about the campaign with Hillary Clinton in that debate. And I have no idea whether he is or not. But if he isn't, he's acting like one.
Well, the only world leader he never criticizes is Vladimir Putin.
Putin, yeah.
No dismissive, derisive nickname. Mm. He treats allies with disdain, as you've said, in a way that is unprecedented, I think. And he refuses to criticize Putin. Now, I don't necessarily subscribe to, you know, I think New York Magazine had a piece last week claiming that, you know, he's an actual kind of agent. Manchurian candidate. Yeah. He's an agent of the Russian state. I don't think that's true. I want to apologize to a member of the public. Right before the election, I did an event. You might have been there at the National Library.
Yes, I remember this.
Right, and you may recall that somebody asked me about Russian interference in the election. I was speculating and trying to explain how the election might unfold, and of course I got it wrong.
I think you got a lot of things wrong in that talk. You also guaranteed that Hillary was going to win, you know. Okay.
Thank you, David. I was just saying that.
Yeah, fine. Which is not, if I were up on that podium, I would have made all the same mistakes. So I think you were espousing conventional wisdom. But
one member of the public asked me about Russian interference in the election, and I have to confess I was rather dismissive. Among the things I got wrong in that talk, that was one that's really stuck with me. Now, in my defense, I think he was talking about, they're going to hack the voting machines and things like that. And I don't think that happened. There's no evidence yet of that happening. But clearly there was Russian interference. We now have enough evidence, and security services in the United States and in the UK have concluded this, and other allied powers. I mean, so there's...
And they have indictments.
Real evidence for this, notwithstanding Trump's constant complaints about witch hunts. Anyway, I want to apologize to that member of the public in particular, if he is listening to this, which I doubt. but the evidence does seem strong. I mean, I don't think Trump is a Russian agent. I don't think we're watching an episode of The Americans. However, there is something about his behavior towards, or his relationship with Putin and his behavior towards Russia that's difficult to explain.
Yeah.
It's difficult to explain without, and I assume someday we'll know.
No, I hope. I mean, he's not only...
I think it's his tax returns. I think it's more likely financial than anything.
I mean, the one thing that strikes me is not only his hostility to our allies in terms of the way he's treating individual people, but his hostility towards institutions that have been sort of the backbone of, you know, Atlantic diplomacy since the Second World War. I mean, in particular,
stability.
And his hostility to NATO as an institution. Just to sort of give a sort of background to NATO. I mean, NATO was formed in 1949. You know, in the aftermath of the Second World War, the sort of particular sort of pushing motivations for the formation of NATO was the Berlin blockade in 1948, the coup in Czechoslovakia in the same year, there's a treaty in Brussels, which is why NATO is headquarters in Brussels, and that later sort of morphs into NATO itself. You know, and the premise of NATO is that countries who are part of the organization are going to be pledged to mutual self-defense. Article 5 of the NATO Charter says that an attack upon one is an attack upon all of them. And it was designed to respond to both real and perceived Soviet aggression in the late 1940s and onwards throughout the Cold War. You know, and it was really one of the foundational organizations, you know, to help counter both real and perceived Soviet aggression throughout the Cold War. If the United States won the Cold War, if we can sort of say anybody won the Cold War, it was largely because of NATO, because of working with close allies like Britain, like Canada, like France, which actually sort of dropped out of NATO briefly at one point, but for the most of it was a member of NATO, and really the rest of Western Europe.
And knitting Germany into the Western security establishment.
Or of course, West Germany and then Germany.
Because, you know, to some extent, the creation of the EU and the creation of NATO in part were about managing Germany, which was obviously a European concern going back to, well,
sure,
centuries.
Yes. And, you know, and if we think about the moment in which NATO was created, it's at the same time as the United States has the Marshall Plan, in which it allocates enormous amount of resources to rebuilding Western Europe on the supposition that an economically healthy Western Europe will be, you know, a stronger friend of the United States. It will stop the spread of communism. It will, you know, be, even if it's a financial expense for the United States, it will be to our long-term stability and benefit to have Western Europe successful. You know, it's really been the bedrock of American foreign policy since the Second World War. It's built upon, you know, NATO as being one of the sort of cornerstones of that. Now, obviously, NATO has changed. I mean, NATO changed after the Cold War. There was some sort of reevaluation of the purposes of NATO after the Cold War. You know, there's some military cutbacks that take place within NATO once the Soviet Union doesn't need to be contained anymore, because if there isn't a Soviet Union contained anymore, they have a bunch of new members that join. Hungary, Czech Republic, Poland all joined, and those were all obviously Soviet sphere countries during the Cold War. But the one time that Article 5 has been evoked, what do you know?
It was after 9/11.
After 9/11, right? So the one time that's been used is, you know, when the United States was attacked. And I'm deeply troubled about the status of NATO, because...
Well, yeah, and your original point was that Trump has this hostility towards NATO, which is a little bit hard to explain. I mean, the other night on Fox News, Tucker Carlson, who's one of the bloviators over there, had some words to the effect of, like, why should my son have to defend Montenegro? Well, Montenegrins, hundreds of Montenegrin soldiers have actually fought beside the United States in Afghanistan after 9/11. So that's why, frankly.
Yes.
And there's a fundamental misunderstanding, and this comes from the president himself, about what NATO is, and you've ably summed up its origins, but also how it works.
Yes.
So Trump seems to labor under this delusion, and I will call it a delusion, that somehow NATO countries owe the United States money for their defense. And that, so in other words, he often says, we're defending them. So you'll cite the presence of American troops in Germany, for example. And he seems to be expecting the Germans to pay for that. When the way NATO is supposed to work is its members are committed to investing a certain proportion of their GDP into defense. Now, the United States commits more than other nations by an order of magnitude, in fact, and spends more than other nations on defense by an order of magnitude. But that's not really the point.
So he
was demanding last week that they increase, that they spend 4% of their GDP on defense.
Like 5%.
Nobody spends 4%. The United States doesn't spend 4%. It spends 3%, I think.
Yeah.
And I think most NATO countries are supposed to spend 2%. And some do it and some don't. So there's an issue there, but he doesn't understand that.
No.
It's more a case of he thinks that Britain should be sending crates of money, or gold probably, to Washington to pay for common defense. And that's not how it works. He just doesn't understand that.
And throughout the history of NATO, you know, the United States has always shouldered, I don't want to say a disproportionate amount of the burden, but at least, you know, carries their own weight sometimes more than some other countries, in part because, at the end of World War II, Europe was devastated the European economies were devastated. The United States comparatively was, you know, the superpower of the world and could afford to establish military bases in Germany and do all these kinds of things where some of our allies weren't in a position to do
well,
that.
Well, they also weren't all that eager to see their allies get too strong either.
Yeah, to be sure.
So there was an element of that involved.
You know, and this sort of notion that all of the, you know, NATO allies should be spending military resources at the same pace as the United States does. One can make an argument that the United States is the outlier there. The United States should spend less.
Spend more on healthcare.
Yeah, well, you know, the United States spends more on military than the rest of the world combined, which I think is a problem in and of itself. But so, the, you know, the status of NATO right now, I think, is it's in the air because, I mean, one of the premises of Article 5 is that you know, if somebody's attacked, you will respond. There's not sort of a, well, think about responding. And right now, you know, what should happen at a NATO summit is all the leaders pledge to uphold Article 5, this sort of mutual self-defense. You know, and right now, if you're a NATO member country, let's imagine you are Poland, which has a history of being attacked by its neighbors. I'm not sure the United States would come to Poland's defense right now, even if we are a member, you know.
Right. I mean, I actually think, it probably would come to Poland's defense. I mean, one thing to say is, in terms of Russia's strategic vision, Russia saw the accession of former Warsaw Pact countries into NATO
yes.
as an aggressive step by the United States and its Western allies, Western European allies, at Russia's expense. So that's kind of a crucial part of the backdrop for this, especially as far as Putin sees the world as a former KGB guy. I don't think Russia's going to attack Poland, but we've already seen Russia annex Crimea, and Trump was hinting last week that he's okay with that. We've seen Russia and Russian allied forces waging war in eastern Ukraine to acquire territory. I think far more likely than a Russian intervention in Poland causing a crisis for NATO would be something smaller but still significant, like a Russian intervention in one of the Baltic states in the justified, kind of in the name of defending Russian-speaking minorities, which exist in all of those countries. And then in the same way that Russia intervened in Crimea.
Yes.
And then NATO facing a crisis because the Baltic states are NATO countries as well, about what to do about that. And Trump is our, you know, we don't know what was said during that 2-hour meeting when Trump met Putin alone. You know, did they discuss that? Who knows?
No.
But I think that's a more likely scenario that could fracture NATO than, and it's a variation of the scenario you gave. I think Poland's probably relatively secure.
Well, I was picking a country out of the hat, but I mean, the premise is like, you know, under normal circumstances, you know, NATO members know that they all have each other's backs, that you know, this is an alliance that is, you know, important to all of its members, and that there's not going to be any hesitation. You know, and whereas I think with Trump, the way he treats at least his sort of disposition at the summit in Brussels, I don't think anybody, you know, in as much as the president has the ability to control the U.S. military, which is, you know, almost absolute, then there's, you know, he could say, what's in it for us? And I think that's, you know, a concern, that would be a concern for me if I were a, you know, foreign head of state, you know, thinking about, does the United States have my back?
Absolutely. Now, one of the things some press reports have suggested since the beginning of the Trump presidency, that at the level of the kind of officers who work at NATO, that basically, American officers and American diplomats, the few that are left, are sending signals to their counterparts saying, don't worry about it, it's all bluster.
Yeah.
They don't know that necessarily. So you do wonder how, I think at the level of public discourse, the kind of concern you've expressed is real.
Yeah.
But I don't know whether kind of, when people from the CIA talk to their counterparts in MI6 in London, is it business as usual because they share intelligence and essentially they're so highly integrated that it would be impossible to separate them?
Sure.
And they more or less roll their eyes and say, don't worry about it. Or Are they worried? And we don't know. We simply don't know.
Well, so one of the things I've noticed, and I noticed this in the statements of foreign officials and in the protests last week, is, you know, the hostility or the concerns are not about the United States. They're not being directed as being about the United States. They're often saying it's about the White House or about Trump himself. And, you know, I think there's lots of, I noticed, like, I think it was the French foreign minister.
It was,
I think
the German foreign minister, Heiko Maas.
Yeah, and he was commenting, you know, about his concerns about not about America, but about the White House, and drawing the distinction between those two things.
He said Germany no longer can rely on the White House. Yes. He didn't say the United States. You're right. And I think that was it. These people choose their words carefully, unlike President Trump. And I think you're absolutely right that was deliberate.
And likewise, in the protests in the UK, the protests were all about hostile to Trump as an individual and his particular policies. I didn't get a sense that they were anti-American.
No, and as I said a few minutes ago, that the protests in 2003-04 were more anti-American, I think, about the invasion of Iraq than the ones last weekend about Trump. They were much more ad hominem directed at Trump.
Yes.
And Trumpism, if you will. I think there are two reasons for that. First of all, Trump is sui generis. He is an outlier.
Mm.
The other thing is the kind of right-wing populist nationalism fused with racism that we've seen in among Trump supporters, and that could be described as Trumpism, isn't unique to the United States at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've seen populists elected in Italy. We've seen populists elected in other countries, and the Brexit vote at some level was drawing on some of these themes. And so I think there's a sense that this is a transnational struggle against these forces represented by Trump, and that it's not a problem of one country, but actually it's a kind of international challenge.
I think you're right about that. So McCain seemed to suggest that what Trump was doing in Helsinki was unprecedented, and I think lots of other political commentators have made similar kinds of claims. If we're going to try to find an analogy for what happened at Helsinki, which events jump out at you as being, if not the same, at least closest to what happened?
So, you and I talked about this a little bit this morning before we went on the air. I can't think of one. I mean, I guess one way to frame it is, what were the most disastrous summit meetings you can ever think of? And you mentioned Munich.
Yeah, so Munich is, you know, and probably the this wasn't Munich. I mean, obviously, for the Cliff Note version in 1938, the Nazis, which were sort of remilitarizing, had annexed part of Czechoslovakia, the Sudetenland. The premise behind it being to reunify German-speaking peoples. These were parts of the Czechoslovakia that were physically within the boundary of Czechoslovakia, but were culturally and linguistically German. At least that's what the Nazis claimed. And it was about sort of how do you respond to sort of the German territorial aggression. Most famously, this is when British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain went to Munich and came back and said, "We're going to have peace in our time."
Acquiesced in the German annexation.
If you give the Germans what they want, then Germans will be happy being Germans, and they will just, you know, leave it at that. It turns out, obviously, that Chamberlain got all of that wrong.
But I think that actually comparing Chamberlain to Trump does a disservice to Chamberlain.
Yes.
And the difficult spot he was in 1938. And also, 1938 was a real crisis. This is a crisis entirely of Trump's making. There was no reason for him to meet with Putin.
Well, I mean, one could imagine an alternative hypothetical situation in which a different person is in the White House. You've got, let's imagine, Hillary Clinton in the White House going to meet with Putin now in the aftermath of Crimea, in the aftermath of Russian support for the Syrian regime, and in an aftermath of the indictment of 12 Russian nationals for interfering with the American election. and going
shooting down the Malaysian airline
and shooting down the Malaysian airline and 25 and killing, you know, former Russian citizens on foreign soil and assassinations and killing journalists and 25 other things, right? Being a bad actor on the world stage and having them go and say, this is unacceptable behavior. The United States, you know, will not tolerate Russia behaving in this way. We demand the extradition of those 12 Russian nationals for violation of U.S. law. One could imagine somebody, you know, this actually being a crisis moment in terms of the relationship between the two countries and, you know, a different leader than Trump standing up to Russia rather than trying to, you know, Trump's behavior in some ways seems very much like in a moment of appeasement. Like, I understand, you know, Putin and... I mean, Putin's a weird guy in as much as, if you remember when George W. Bush met with Putin the first time, George W. Bush said, I met with Putin, I saw into his soul, and he's a good guy. And it turns out that George W. Bush later realized he was wrong about that. You know, later under Obama, Hillary Clinton met with Putin on the, he tried to sort of reset U.S.-Russian relations. And she walked out of that, not quite seeing into his soul, but hoping that there was a positive relationship going to come out of it. I'm not quite sure what it is about meeting with Putin that seems that often people, Americans, walk into it, at least initial meetings with him, thinking they're going to have a good relationship with him.
I think there are two things at work there. I think one is, first of all, this is the way, that's the language of diplomacy. Oh, to be sure. So some of it is just spin because you have to say something nice. Secondly, let's not forget this guy's background is in intelligence.
Sure.
He was, you know, he ran the KGB, he was a KGB officer. He understands the worlds of intelligence and counterintelligence. He knows how to play people. Every world leader knows how to play Trump, which is you praise him, you flatter him, you appeal to his vanity. So I don't think Trump's all that difficult to play, but I think you're right. I mean, I think if we take these statements made by American politicians and diplomats at their word, then what we see is Putin has got a long track record of successfully manipulating the people who come to see him. It was, you know, the whole choreography, such as it was of that summit, and I'm using summit advisedly now, was very interesting. So Putin turned up an hour late. He kept Trump waiting. If you look at the photographs, the body language, you know, Putin, we can make too much of this, but Putin is clearly running the show and pulling the strings there. And he knows what he's doing. Yeah. He's doing it deliberately.
And Trump likes to be the alpha dog in the room.
Right. And he was not the alpha dog. Putin probably spent the weekend. I mean, he went to the World Cup final on Sunday, but he was preparing for that summit. Trump spent the weekend golfing in Turnberry in Ayrshire. He was not preparing. He wasn't reading briefing books.
No.
Believe it or not, if you're going to go to these big international meetings, you have to do your homework first. No.
And usually there are, you know, months of preparation, and it's all pretty scripted what's going to happen anyway. And this was, I mean, Trump said beforehand, I'm going to show up to this and basically wing it.
Which is what he did in Singapore.
Which is what he seems to like. That's what he does with everything.
Now, interestingly, because he believes he's a successful deal maker, he thinks that he can just kind of go with his instincts. Back to this question of what motivates him and what leverage the Russians may or may not have over him, you'd think if he actually were a Russian asset, to use the language of espionage, they would have told him, you can push back a little bit and make you look better. I mean, it's kind of abasing himself, to use Senator McCain's word before Putin, actually was counterproductive to Russian interests because it spurred a backlash in the United States.
He's a very bad
asset. So bizarrely, that actually speaks to, that could be evidence to the contrary.
I mean, one of the things that struck me in the press conference is, you know, his failure to actually articulate what the American position is on issues like Crimea. And actually, at one point, Putin summarized the U.S. position on Crimea, saying that the United States didn't see it as legitimate, better than Trump did. You know, and it was quite striking.
I am sure that Vladimir Putin has probably read more about the American position on Crimea than Donald Trump has.
I think you're probably right about that, yes.
Not least because Crimea is obviously a more immediate interest to Russia, but also he will do his homework.
Yes. If nothing else, I think Putin is doing his homework.
Yes, and Trump is not. Every time Trump makes one of these statements, I mean, did you hear when he was asked at the Checkers press conference, and he was asked about Brexit, and he asked whether he thought a hard Brexit is going to happen, and he said, "Do I think it's heartbreaking? Yes, it's heartbreaking." Well, heartbreaking is a little strong. He misheard it, or he deliberately misheard it because he had no idea what what hard Brexit was.
Yes.
When, of course, you think if you were going to meet Theresa May,
yes,
you would have been briefed on Brexit.
And if you're going to give an interview at The Sun, where
about
Brexit, yes.
And he just had no clue. And so he is winging it almost all the time, it seems.
Yes.
And it's very, very difficult to do that in the realm of foreign relations. Because...
You know, and there are times when there are U.S. presidents who clearly don't understand foreign relations. There were times when... Gerald Ford demonstrated he didn't really know what he was talking about. There are times when George W. Bush couldn't, you know, confuse Slovenia and Slovakia, which is a perfectly reasonable thing to confuse, I guess, unless one is going to become the leader of the free world. But they try to disguise their ignorance by you know, obfuscating and not sort of diving into questions they clearly know nothing about. Trump doesn't seem to have that apprehension about exposing his ignorance on top.
No, because he thinks he can bluff his way through anything. I mean, Reagan's a good example. Reagan, by all accounts, was not a details person.
No.
Yet Reagan was guided by a kind of strategic vision where foreign relations was concerned.
And he surrounded himself with detailed people who could do that kind of stuff for
arms
him.
Arms control, yeah, and things like that. Whereas, you know, Trump has surrounded himself with a changing cast of characters, and they don't seem to be on top of their briefs, let's say, and their responsibilities. Yeah.
But if anything, you know, one of the things this trip has demonstrated, and I think this is something his entire administration has demonstrated, is Trump's ignorance of American history, and especially the past century of American history, is really quite profound and is very much shaping, you know, the sort of blunders he walks into, if that's what they are, you know, in terms of how he treats NATO allies. I don't think he fully understands where NATO came from and why it's important. I don't think he understands the special relationship, which is not a term I particularly like, but we're going to go with it. You know, I think you don't think he understands the history of U.S. and British relations. I don't think he understands, this is bizarre how he doesn't understand this, I don't think he understands the history of U.S. and Russian relationship, despite the fact that he was alive for
the Cold War.
The Cold War.
I mean, it was Republican orthodoxy to be skeptical and anti-Soviet and then Russian, really for much of the past century.
Yes.
Well, in fact, for the past century, certainly since the Bolshevik Revolution.
Yes.
And Trump, you're right, doesn't seem to be aware of that at all. He likes that Putin's a strong man. He needs to go to Normandy like you did, David, and see, you know, you go to Normandy and you think, okay... I mean, I think we sometimes make too much of this, and we see the world in military terms at our cost sometimes. But go to Normandy and see those graves of British, American, Polish, Allied forces, and Canadians, etc., French. They're all there.
Yes.
If you've been to Normandy, it's very hard to critique NATO and the European Union.
Yes.
Because and Trump has no awareness of that. He simply has no awareness of that. I was in Britain in 1994 during the 50th anniversary of D-Day, and I remember Bill Clinton coming and speaking incredibly powerfully then. And it seemed then that the Transatlantic Alliance, which was in a transition moment because the Soviet Union. The wall had come down, the Soviet Union had collapsed. But it seemed that the kind of unraveling we're seeing now was unthinkable. And now, 25 years later, I think it's 50-50 whether it survives.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think if he has a historical connection or sort of vision in his mind of what he's doing. I mean, I have to imagine he's thinking of himself as Ronald Reagan and Putin as Gorbachev, and that there you know, going to be, you know, historic figures on the world stage, which is not what's going on in the slightest. Putin and Gorbachev are very dissimilar actors. And he is not, you know, doesn't have that combination. And I can't believe I'm praising Reagan to this extent, but he doesn't have the combination of Reagan's ability to say simultaneously, you know, tear down this wall and to be able to negotiate arms reductions. I don't think he has that level of sophistication or political understanding.
No, I agree. Right. What's interesting, and I know we need to wrap up, is there's a kind of contrast between Trump's first overseas trip, which he saw as a great success, and Fox News credited him for a great success, which was, that was when he went to Saudi Arabia and danced with the swords and the orb, and then he went on to Israel and visited Netanyahu, and you know, that trip, by contrast with this one, first of all, he's uncomfortable visiting Democratic states because there are public protests and there's pushback, and you know, that's what democracies do. And he clearly just is incapable of managing these events. And unless he's willing to do his homework, it seems unlikely he's going to become better at it. In fact, if you look at that first overseas trip, which he made early in his presidency, compared to this one, he seems to be getting worse. And then we look at Singapore in between. Exactly. He's getting worse.
I think you're right about that.
He's getting worse. And let's not forget the G7 summit in Canada before he went to Singapore. He's getting worse at this.
I think that's right. I mean, what's striking is that, you know, he's always been criticized on the left for these trips and for his behavior on them. This recent trip, I think even Fox News was sort of baffled by his performance, and you know, Republicans in Congress are still kind of doing nothing, but at least they're doing nothing and doing it with a frown on their face.
Well, unless and until they're actually willing to take action, nothing will change, to be sure.
But it does seem like he's even... his usual cheerleaders are not cheering as loudly as they usually do.
Well, there's very little to claim in this. How do you spin this?
Maybe he played two good rounds of golf.
Right, yeah.
But he owns the golf course, so we know.
So we'll never know.
All right, so it's time for last drops. But before we do that, I want to give a shout out to a podcast listener, Jasmine, who I met at a conference at UCL this week, who recently graduated from university and is contemplating PhD work in history, and says she's a loyal listener, and just want to say hi to Jasmine out there, and it was really nice to meet you in person.
Excellent. And I met another listener also on my travels, Simon. Simon is a fan of the podcast too, and praised us for it and expressed thanks. So I want to thank him. We want to thank all of our listeners.
Yes, but we
love these encounters. Actually, yes. It's very nice to meet listeners, and it's gratifying and a little surprising.
Exactly.
Most of it's I listen to your podcast.
Okay. Really? Great.
We're grateful to all of you.
So what's your last drop then?
My last drop is a hashtag that started this week. Hashtag H-A-T-M.
And what does H-A-T-M stand
it's
for?
Historians at the Movies.
Historians at the Movies.
So if you're on Twitter, you can have a look at this hashtag. What it is historians watching movies. A bunch of historians, and Joanne Freeman at Yale, who's a friend of the pod and a personal friend, was prominent in this. They watched the terrible Nicolas Cage movie, National Treasure, this week, and then they live tweeted while they were doing it. So if you go to the hashtag HATM, you can see these tweets, and they're about to watch Lincoln.
Okay. That's a very different kind of movie than
National Treasure. But watching historians opine in real time as they all watch a movie together.
Yeah, yeah.
Very interesting. So I enjoyed that. Hashtag HATM. Okay. Historians of the Movies.
All right.
What about you, David?
I want to endorse a website, Women Also Know History. And the premise behind this website is very often when... media and other sort of public outlets, you know, look for historians, they end up sort of recycling the same middle-aged and older white academics, white male academics.
You mean like us?
Like us. Yes, they basically, you know, and so you see the same talking heads commenting on history you know, on television and radio and other things. And so the premise behind this website is that there seems to be an underrepresentation of women historians in these kind of public venues. And journalists, when they're asked, you know, why don't you contact historians X, Y, and Z, who are clearly experts on the topic you just interviewed male historian on. Sometimes the male historian isn't even an expert on that particular topic. Why didn't you contact these people who have actually done, you know, important research on this? The journalists often say, well, I didn't know about those women historians. Well, the premise of the website, therefore, is this is a place where you can go, and if you want to have a greater diversity of voices, you know, as a journalist or another public venues, this is a place where you can go and find.
So they register.
We register women who are, and we actually have lots of colleagues, people we both know who have registered on this. So it's a great repository. So if you're looking to have greater gender balance in terms of public presentations, or if you're looking to set up, you know, conference proposals, and you want to make sure it's not just the same old white guys that you usually have, this is a great way to have a sort of greater diversity. Because I think one of the great things about our profession at the moment, in fact, is that we have a fairly diverse profession, that the you know, academic historians in particular are a really diverse group of people, but you wouldn't know that necessarily watching historians on television where they get the same three or four guys for everything. So I think this is a useful resource for changing the public, how the public sees historians, by getting more women out there in the public, in the media and other places.
Excellent.
Great.
All right. Cheers, David.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod, and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.